This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This coming Friday, September 20th, millions of people are expected to leave their classrooms or their jobs or however they spend their days and march to demand action from government leaders on climate change. With every record-setting heat wave, with every extreme storm, it's harder to deny the reality. Climate change is here, right now, and it's already causing us urgent problems. Two of our contributors have been sounding the alarm for decades. Bill McKibben essentially broke the news of climate change to a wider public with his book, The End of Nature, and that work was first published in The New Yorker in 1989. And staff writer Elizabeth Colbert, who covers climate change for The New Yorker, wrote The Sixth Extinction, which won the Pulitzer Prize. We spoke earlier this year just after the UN published a report that 1 million species are at risk of extinction. Betsy, I hate to be a competitive journalist, but when I read the report about the sixth extinction in the UN report, I said, the New Yorker had that 10 years ago when you published in 2009, the very same thing. Well, what is the difference between 2009 and 2019 in terms of the extinction of hundreds of thousands of species on the planet Earth?
Well, I think that, I mean, it's one of those cases where, you know, as I'm sure Bill would say, you don't sort of like to see the news bearing out what you said. But in this case, you know, it really is. The only difference is, you know, more documented destruction, really, and a lot more studies piled on the ones, you know, that were available to us 5-10 years ago. But, you know, the general trend line of biodiversity lost, it's all just playing out, you know, sort of according to plan, unfortunately. And it's true that, you know, global GDP is larger than ever. And at the same time, you know, species loss and destruction of the natural environment, natural world is also greater than ever. And those two things are very intimately linked. And if you only pay attention, you know, to the GDP part, you might say, oh, everything's fine. But I think what the point that this report is really trying to make is those lines are going to cross. You know, people are still dependent on the natural world. All the oxygen we breathe, all the food we eat, all the water, you know, these are biological and geochemical systems that we're still dependent on, for better or worse, and we are mucking with them in the most profound ways. I think that that is the message, the take-home message of that report.
Bill, I was really interested to read that you think that the great climate change document of our time is by Pope Francis.
Well, I think that the encyclical that he wrote 3.5 years ago now, Laudato Si, is amazing, mostly because though it takes off from climate change, it's actually a fairly thorough and remarkable critique of modernity. And it talks really about precisely the things that Betsy's been talking about. To understanding this as, yes, a problem of physics and of the need to put up a lot of solar panels and wind turbines, which we now can do because the engineers have made them affordable, but also understanding it as a problem of human beings and their relations with each other. As Francis points out, you know, the last 40 years, this period of time when we've worshipped markets and assumed they solved all problems, has not only spiked the temperature through the roof, it's spiked inequality through the roof, and the two are not unrelated.
How are they related? What is the essential relationship between the two?
One of the things I spent some time doing in this new book is kind of teasing out the history that begins with Ayn Rand and kind of reaches a first zenith in the Reagan administration. And the idea that government is the problem, that if you leave corporations alone, they'll get done what needs doing, this reigning ideology came just at the wrong moment. It came at precisely the moment when we actually needed governments to be doing something very strong to deal with climate change. And that combination of ideology and interest has been enough to suppress our reactions in the crucial 30 years. I mean, David, we're basically out of presidential cycles in order to deal with this problem.
How do you mean? What's the math on the UN?
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued their most recent report, and it was by far their most pointed to date. It said if really fundamentally transformative work was not well underway by 2030, then we were not going to catch up with the math of climate change. Physics was going to just be too far ahead in this race. And you know enough about political life in this country or any other to know that a decade is a short period of time. If we want to have anything substantial happening in a decade, then we have got to be doing it right away.
You know, for nearly 20 years that I've been working together with Betsy, the running joke between us is about Betsy's pessimism, which is well-founded, but we managed to joke about it anyway. And Bill, early on in Falter, your new book, you write, "There is one sense in which I am less grim than in my younger days. This book ends with the conviction that resistance to these dangers is at least possible. And I sense in both of you, each in your own way," and it might be different, but each in your own way, "some sense of hope is informing your work now in 2019 the way it might not have 5 years ago." Am I right, Betsy?
I hope I haven't given you that impression, David.
he said, hopefully.
Hopefully the dog came home. I think, you know, I'll play my usual role here.
Eeyore.
You know, Eeyore. I think that I do see glimmers of hope on a political front, but it's sort of like mountains after mountains after mountains. And I think, as I say, the facts on the ground, climate change, the thing that distinguishes it from a lot of other environmental problems is it's cumulative. You know, it's not something where you can say at the moment you don't like things, you know, let's undo them. There's a lot of time lag in the system. There's a lot of inertia in the system. And we are
in the system, meaning in science, that there's
no, in the climate system. So
right.
We have not yet experienced the full impact of the greenhouse gases we have already put up there. And once we do, you know, in whatever, a decade or so, there's a sort of a long tail to that, you know, we will have put up that much more. So we're always chasing this problem. And you can't decide, once we decide, oh, we really don't like this climate, you don't get the old climate back for, you know, many, many, many generations. So we are fighting a very, very, very uphill battle. And I think, you know, the point that Bill has made, and I agree with it, is it maybe we can avoid, you know, the worst possible future. But I don't think at this point we can avoid a lot of damage.
And we're seeing it already.
We're seeing it, but it's just beginning. And it's not just beginning, then we can turn it around. It's just beginning, and a lot more is built in.
What can be held back, Bill, and what can't be held back at this point?
Well, I mean, look, Betsy's right. The problem with climate change is that it's a timed test. And if you don't solve it fast, then you don't solve it. No one's got a plan for refreezing the Arctic once it's melted. And we've lost now 70 or 80% of the summer sea ice in the Arctic. So that's a tipping point more or less crossed. The oceans are 30% more acidic than they used to. So we're not playing for stopping climate change. We're playing maybe for being able to slow it down to the point where it doesn't make civilizations impossible. Here's the hopeful case, if you want it. 50 years ago, next spring, we had the first Earth Day in 1970. 20 million people, 1 in 10 of the then American population, went into the street. And that anger transformed the flavor of this issue in America. Over the next 4 years, Richard Nixon, who had not an environmental bone in his body, signed every piece of legislation on which we still depend. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act that Betsy described as now under siege. Those all came because of that outpouring of public energy that shifted the zeitgeist. We better do it again and in spades.
Elizabeth Culbert, Bill McKibben, authors of really the essential works on climate change these last 30 years. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Friday, September 20th, is the climate strike taking place around the world. And the UN's Climate Action Summit starts Friday as well. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. An exodus seems to be underway in the House of Representatives. We're not even halfway into the congressional term, and 15 Republicans have already announced their retirements ahead of the 2020 elections. One member making for the exits is Will Hurd, a former CIA officer who once managed undercover operations in Afghanistan. Hurd was elected from a district in Texas in 2014, and he's seen as a moderate. His announcement is significant because Hurd is, for the 16 months he has left to serve, the only African American in the House Republican caucus. Our Washington correspondent Susan Glasser caught up with Will Hurd last week at his office on Capitol Hill.
So, Congressman, national security is one of your abiding interests, and obviously it's the through line between your unique service as an undercover CIA agent and a member of Congress. We're in the middle of yet another upheaval on President Trump's national security team. He's now dumped his third national security advisor, who knows, you know, who will replace John Bolton or what that means in terms of the administration's foreign policy. The backdrop to this latest round of chaos is Ambassador Bolton apparently objecting to the president's plan to bring the Taliban to Camp David.
It's wild.
These were the guys shooting at you.
No, absolutely. And these are the guys that are still shooting at our men and women in the military, but also our allies. And that's what makes this outrageous. So I think everybody agrees that being able to decrease our posture in Afghanistan specifically would be a positive thing. However, we can't ever let that place become a location where terrorists can train, equip, and continue attacks on the homeland. Now, when we negotiate with a group of people, you can't give everything away and get nothing in return. So they were negotiating in bad faith, the Taliban I'm speaking of, by continuing to do attacks while you're trying to negotiate an agreement. I do believe when you're talking, you're not fighting, generally. And in this case, that may not necessarily be the case. And knowing Ambassador Bolton, I'm sure he was, like me, outraged by this idea. And I think if I read the tea leaves, I don't think the right verb we should be using is anything relating to firing. Mm-hmm. I think John Bolton decided that this was not something that he can continue to do.
You know, often in conversations in Washington, there's a difficulty of, you know, sort of bridging the gap between the national security conversation, the foreign policy world, and then the sort of political world, domestic politics. You physically straddle that line, I think, by representing a district on the border with Mexico. And one of the things that you've most consistently spoken out about over the last couple years is this vexing question of President Trump's border wall, both the existence and need for it, which you've been opposed to, and then also the question of how he's gone about funding it, the question of why immigration reform, while broadly supported until very recently by people in both parties, has been impossible to achieve. So what is Washington screwing up about this? What did they get wrong about your district?
Well, I wish I could pass a piece of legislation that says you can't talk about the border unless you've been down to the border a few times. Because
was required for expertise in Washington, we'd be in trouble.
Right. Look, every mile of the border is different from every other mile. I represent 820 miles of the border. It's about 2/3 of the border between Texas and Mexico. And
you go almost from the San Antonio suburbs
to El Paso, yeah. Right? So along the border, the town is called Eagle Pass, all the way to El Paso. And there are parts of the border where Border Patrol's response time to a threat mm-hmm. is measured in hours to days. Mm-hmm. So if you have a threat and it's going to take the good guys, it's going to take them hours to get there, a wall is actually not a physical barrier. It's a colossal waste of money. And so building a wall from sea to shining sea is the most expensive and least effective way to do border security. We should be using more technology. And unfortunately, most people believe that we have the latest and greatest technology along the border. Unfortunately, it's like 20 years old. And a lot of these tools that we have down there, you have to have a PhD in computer science in order for it to operate. So the men and women that are putting themselves in harm's way in order to protect our border don't have the resources they need. We also need more men and women in Border Patrol, and we don't have enough. And so we can secure our border. Another way what we should be operating on, and when you look at the humanitarian crisis that we're dealing with right now and the number of illegal folks that are coming into our country, it's going to be the highest it's been in a really long time.
President Trump calls that an invasion. Is it an invasion?
Look, is it illegal? I would say it's illegal immigration, right? That's the accurate word. And we have to address the root causes of the problem. The root causes of the problem is violence, lack of economic opportunity, and extreme poverty in the Northern Triangle. That's El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And what we should be doing is leading with American soft power in those areas, that's economic and development aid, to help restructure many of those countries, because it's a fraction of the cost to solve the problem there before having to deal with it when it gets to our borders. We should be getting the entire Western Hemisphere involved in solving this problem.
Is opposition to the wall, is that one of the reasons driving this incredible exodus of Texas Republicans like yourself out of the House of Representatives. You're one now, I believe it's five Republican members, many of whom are pretty senior, who've made a decision not to run again for re-election. What's going on there?
No, I don't. It doesn't have anything to do with my decision or my positions. For me, it's real simple. The president of the United States is not my boss. The Speaker of the House is not my boss, right? My bosses are the 800,000 people that I represent. And I agree when I agree, I disagree when I disagree. I did it under the last president, I've done it under this president. And so for me, I believe it's an opportunity for me to serve my country in a different way. I haven't talked to the other members of the Texas delegation about their decision, but these are positions, we shouldn't want someone staying in these positions for decades, right? I've always said to do the job well, you have a shelf life of 6, 7, 8 years because of the travel and the activity. And so this was a logical time for me. And I also want to help candidates across the country that would have been great partners for me when I was up here. And the way to do that is to go in and help those candidates in their districts and do that across the country. So I'm looking forward to doing that in this upcoming election cycle, because here's the reality as a Republican, and I tell this to my colleagues in Texas, and this is applicable for the rest of the country. If the Republican Party in Texas doesn't start looking like Texas, there won't be a Republican Party in Texas. And in 2020, Texas is a purple state, meaning in essence, a basketball reference, it's a jump ball. Democrats can win just because there's not a statewide elected Democrat.
Which, by the way, is an amazing statement in and of itself. I remember when we first started Politico magazine a few years ago, actually right when you came to Congress in 2014, and we ran an article that said Texas is going to become a purple state. And people were like, that's crazy. That's crazy. It was not viewed as a successful piece of political analysis.
No, but it's true. And so when you look at who are the two largest growing groups of voters, minorities and young people, people under the age of 29 will be a third of the electorate in 2020. These are places where the Republican brand doesn't resonate as well as it could and should. And there's an opportunity, right? There's an opportunity because independents and Democrats are concerned with the direction that their party is going. And so there's an opportunity here. And I truly believe that a competition of ideas is important for us to be able to meet these generational defining challenges that are at our doorstep.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about opportunity. We're sitting behind in your office here. You've got a framed copy of Texas Monthly cover that has you on the cover recently as Party of One. And I mentioned you're the only African-American Republican in the House of Representatives. There'll be zero when you're gone. There's one in the Senate. And you also have this incredibly turbocharged rhetoric that we've been seeing, no less from the Twitter feed of the President of the United States, being very critical of some of your fellow members of Congress who are women of color. Is it possible to recruit Republicans of color given this political moment?
It is, and there's some good Republican candidates of color that are running across the country. There's a guy in Houston, Texas, named Wesley Hunt, who's phenomenal, right? Served time in the military. Does it make it more difficult to go to communities that hasn't seen a Republican? Yes, but that's what I've been doing for the last, for my five and a half years in Congress. And so I'm going to continue to do that because our message should resonate. But here's the problem. If people don't trust you or people don't think you care about them, they're not going to listen to what you say.
Well, so in the course of the years that you've been campaigning across this incredibly far-flung, very competitive district, which is an outlier just not only in its size, but because it is competitive between the parties, how has it changed? I mean, has the Republican Party's brand, you think, become more challenging in a district like that because of demographic change, or is it also been accelerated by the politics of the Trump era?
Look, I think when you have statements that talk about the equivalent of go back to Africa, right? That is not helpful, and that takes away from the opportunity, which is to debate whether free markets or socialism is the way you're going to solve problems in the future. And so when you're taking away and making it harder to have those real substantive debates, that's not going to help us electorally. But what I have found is, look, I spend time in areas that people never saw a Republican, and they appreciate that. And that's why I've consistently been successful in a blue wave when, people that weren't very popular on top of the ticket were involved. And so that's how we've been able to survive. And that's proof that the majority of Americans are willing to vote for someone, for an individual, not just because they have a letter after their name. And that's the, and I've been able to prove that in my three terms.
Now, I have to ask you one final question, because I feel like it's an important one. Many people are surprised at how little many of your fellow Republicans have spoken out against the president, even though he disagrees with things that they see as fundamental issues of principle. Are you going to support Donald Trump for re-election in 2020? And do you think that you would have a duty or a responsibility to speak out about your concerns about his fitness for office?
My plan right now is to vote for the Republican nominee, and I'm going to continue to evaluate and speak up and, agree when I agree and disagree when I disagree.
So we'll be hearing from you a lot then.
I'm not bashful.
No, absolutely not. Congressman Will Hurd, thank you again.
Here we are. The pleasure was mine.
The Cannon House Office Building.
317.
Representative Will Hurd of Texas. In August, he announced his retirement from Congress. Susan Glasser writes the weekly column, Letter from Trump's Washington, on NewYorker.com. Stick around, because in a minute, I'll be talking with one of the great women in rock and roll right now, Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes. That's just ahead.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Sometimes Brittany Howard's voice is so smooth, it's just a hot knife through butter. And sometimes there's so much gravel in it that she sounds like some of her elders, like Etta James and Amy Winehouse. Howard has been the front woman of the Alabama Shakes for about a decade now. The group started as a cover band playing around the state of Alabama, and pretty quickly, it came to national attention and a handful of Grammys. But after two albums with the Alabama Shakes, Howard has gathered a different group of musicians to release a solo album called Jamie. The album is named after Brittany Howard's late sister, but it's very much about the singer herself, about her passions, her concerns, and her hard upbringing in Athens, Alabama. I'd love to start out by talking about the music that formed you. I know that you listened to music at the kitchen table with all kinds of relatives. When you listen to your childhood, when you hear it through the mists of time, what music are you listening to? What are you hearing?
Well, I think about like Jodeci, think about Usher way back when. And I think about TLC and Destiny's Child and all the pop groups. And I also think about my grandma in the kitchen cutting onions, listening to doo-wop music. And think about Prince. Think about P-Funk. Just that was my era of growing up.
So when's the first time you picked up a guitar?
To actually learn how to play it, yeah. I was 11 years old.
Mm-hmm. And did you buy one, or it just you decided this is the thing I've got to have?
My sister had a guitar. It's like a Les Paul knockoff, and she had this guitar just like in the closet, and I started sneaking in and grabbing it and learning how to play it.
Forbidden fruit.
Yeah, it was like in storage, because by this time she had already passed, so it was just like my mom saved a lot of her things, and it was kind of like, don't touch her things. But I saw the guitar and taught myself how to play it.
Your sister died when she was how old? She was
13.
She was 13, mm-hmm. of a very rare eye cancer,
yes.
that you've survived it and she died of. And mm-hmm. this new album is very much named for her, Jamie. When you were growing up, that must have been a horrendous rupture in your family life, psychological life. And you weren't allowed to touch her stuff?
It was like precious artifacts, you know? Because it's kind of like all we had left. But, I mean, I picked it up, and that's what I learned on.
And you taught yourself?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
How do you do that?
You just listen. One thing that really helped me when I was younger is they used to have these magazines called Guitar Player Magazine.
Sure.
And in the back, they got the tablature in the back. It would have the bar, and the bar represents each string. And then it would just say, like, five. And then eventually I started figuring out what that meant.
The fifth fret.
Fifth fret on this string. Yeah. And at first I was playing it upside down, and then I was like, that didn't sound right. So the tablature taught me how to play chords.
And at what point did either you recognize or somebody recognize about you, Britney's got talent?
No, nobody really. I mean, sure, like as a kid I was really into it, but I was really terrible for a really long time. I was just trying to figure out.
Just banging away at the guitar.
Yeah, just trying to figure out things just like everybody else. I started writing songs like immediately pretty much. And by the time I was 17, I showed my mom a CD I had made of my songs, and she was like, oh, you can sing. She didn't know I could sing. Nobody, it was like my little secret, you know, because I was just like ruminating, and I was like, nobody can know until I'm good enough, and then I'll let people know.
How'd you teach yourself to sing? Who are you listening to? I want to sing like that. I think your father at one point said that you sounded like Etta James, but that's got to be much later.
Don't listen to my dad.
You still have that cassette of your first songs?
Oh, I don't know where it is. I wish I did.
I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is going to want that.
No, I don't think anybody should hear it, though.
Now, like a lot of teenagers, the thing that you wanted to do was get a band together. You start meeting local musicians, mm-hmm. and you meet Zach Cockrell and Heath Fogg and Steve Johnson, which becomes the formation of Alabama Shakes. What kind of places were you playing?
Oh, not many places. It was really hard to get shows when we were doing original music. But at first we just like did covers, Led Zeppelin, James Brown, AC/DC. And I would just call around trying to get us shows, or usually other bands would say, oh, I've heard of this band. They're from Athens, Alabama. We should let them open for us. So, you know, we weren't getting paid anything, but...
What were you getting paid?
Maybe $200 for everybody.
Just split?
Maybe, yeah. Sometimes not that much. That was substantial.
And at what point, Brittany, do you think, maybe I'll be able to do this for a living? I won't have to play at night and do... You had all kinds of day jobs. You were delivering mail, I think. You were doing all kinds of things.
I remember having a conversation with Zach, you know, the bass player. I remember just sitting on my porch... And I said, you know, Zach, what if we got the opportunity to tour? Would you quit your job and go on tour and try to do it? And he was like, nah. He said, nah, you know, he did. He said, it'd have to pay really good. And I'm just like, oh, okay. And then I never thought that day would come, but one day it did.
There must be someone of a
So now, after two really big albums with Alabama Shakes, you're doing a solo album. Why did you decide so soon in your career, you're now 30, right?
Mm-hmm.
That I'm gonna break off from the group at least for a while, mm-hmm. and pursue this and write this album and do something entirely different?
I think I just, creatively, that's just what was coming to me. It was like this different style of music. And
how would you characterize it?
Just my musical education, that's the way that I would characterize it. Just so many things I've heard that I've liked and then pull it together into these songs and these landscapes. And I, you know, the reason I wanted to do it now as a solo artist is just because I didn't want to ask anyone, do you like this bass part or do you like this arrangement? I just wanted to do my vision, you know.
The album is named for your sister,
mm-hmm.
and she
mm-hmm.
infuses the memory of her time on Earth. It infuses everything about this record. You're getting, you know, as we all are getting, 1 year older, 1 year at a time. How distinctly do you remember her, and what are you able to keep of her as time goes by?
When you lose someone you're really close to, they never leave. It's hard to put into words, really. I'm not a religious person, but I definitely am a spiritual person. And I think just because someone is not here where we can touch them or hear them or feel them, it doesn't mean they're gone. So I feel like my bond with my sister walks with me always. I feel like we're closer than we ever could have been if we were both here in a physical world. So I think about her daily, multiple times a day, yeah.
What runs through your mind?
Oh, just when I'm trying to figure something out, just be like, can you help me with this?
Or, she's talking to you.
I can't hear her. I'm just talking to her, really.
Yeah.
Can you help me through this? What do I do? Just little situations like that in my life where I need some extra strength. Yeah.
There's a song on the album called Short and Sweet. In fact, there's a line toward the end of it that you repeat, time is going to kill it. Tell me about that song. Tell me about those lyrics.
Yeah. That song I wrote when I met my partner about 3 years ago, and I had wrote it because, I'm not going to say I had bad luck in relationships, I was just kind of in several ruts. the sentiment of that song is like, well, I'm falling in love, I'm getting in a new relationship, I wonder how long this one's going to last. And I was like, how nice would it be if we could just stay in the beginning part of the relationship where we're just really getting to know each other and happy, and there's infatuation and there's this excitement. And I was like, it'd be so nice to stay there instead of it going into this place where it's like, and now we're being pulled apart by like touring or just growing apart. And you know what I mean? It's like that nice beginning.
I may be a fool to dream of you, but God, it feels so good to dream at all. Something short and sweet.
I hesitate to ask, what was the result?
Oh, we're married.
So, in the end, it's not a tragic song.
No.
So far, so good.
No, everything worked out better than expected.
So, you made it big with this band, the Alabama Shakes, and you've got three partners in that band. Mm-hmm. How do they feel about you going solo?
At first, when I told them, I had really been marinating it on it for a while, because I was like, I was not... Like, the songs weren't coming to us, and when we were getting together, it was really hard to...
You felt stuck.
Yeah, it felt very stuck, and especially me and, you know, me and the guys, we'd be like, what's going on? Like, why can't we get anything done? And I just wasn't receiving anything.
And is it all on you?
It happened to work out that way.
Yeah.
After Sound and Color, you know, I think...
You're the person people know.
Well, just like creatively, it's like usually the way that things went is I would have ideas and we come in and rehearse them, but I wasn't getting any ideas for this. And some of the ideas I had were just, it wasn't the right, like, ingredients. It wasn't working out. So eventually, I mean, probably after like a year and a half of this, I was like, guys, you know, I think I'm going to do my own record. And at first it was met with like a lot of confusion and disappointment. But then we sat down.
Were they angry?
I'm not sure if they were angry. I think they're more like surprised. But we sat down and we talked about it for several hours. We sat in a circle and I was just like, you know, it's been hard. Yeah, I know. And it was like, well, I'm just going to go do this. And at the end of the conversation, everybody was like, okay, we understand, we get it. Gave me their blessing to go on and find what I needed to find or create what I needed to create.
Did they, in the back of their minds, or do you get the sense that they felt that was the end of the Alabama Shakes?
Probably, yeah.
Is it?
I don't know. Wherever creativity leads my ship, I can't force it. That's the thing. Like, once I start forcing it, it's not going to be no good anyway. You know?
Now, you came up with some new collaborators and some remarkable collaborators, like Robert Glasper, who's, in fact, been on this show, whose talents range from, well, all over the place. He has an album of Miles Davis covers, and he's worked with some of the biggest people in hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
And now with you, why bring on somebody like Robert Glasper? What did he give you, and or Nate Smith, who's also a jazz musician?
I have been watching Rob since he made that Miles Davis tribute record. I was like, wow, this dude is so cool. He did a song with Erykah Badu that I really, really like. And I was like, I'm going to watch his career because that's what I do with musicians. I really respect musicians, and I think their careers matter. I think musicians just, they matter.
Where does Robert Glasper fit in? Where's his influence most powerful on this album? What songs?
13th Century Metal. Funny story behind that one. So before then, Rob, I was just kind of telling him, like, yeah, right here in this section, you know, you can do like this. And right here in this section, I was thinking more like this. But on 13th, you know, he walks into the key room and just starts playing. And Sean Everett, engineer, hits record. And I'm going, what is that? they just jam. Like, Nate Smith joins in, and they just jam. It was incredible. One take and improvised. So I took it and I cut it up and I put that mantra over it.
Tell me about that mantra. It begins, I promise to think before I speak, to be wary of who I give my energy to. It's a really interesting song lyrically as well, even though it was generated by that first musical experience. Tell me about the lyrics to 13th Century Metal.
I know exactly when, in 2016, that's when I wrote it. Because we got a new president. And
I heard that.
And I was I had some feelings.
What were your feelings?
I guess I wrote it all in a mantra. The world seemed like it's just turned upside down and full of darkness. You can feel like the whole world's in a funk, you know.
Do you think that your music or anyone's music can have an effect on the political world in some way?
I do wonder. I mean, there's James Brown. He had an effect on the political world. And then there's someone like Bob Marley. And then there's people like John Lennon. So I think history would say so.
That it can.
Yeah, I think so.
Brittany, your dad is black, your mother is white. And in one of your songs, Goathead, you ask this question, who slashed my dad's tires and put a goat head in the back?
Mm-hmm.
What was that all about?
That's a true story.
Tell me about it.
About 30 years ago, my dad came home from work, was visiting my mother, who was living in these pretty poor apartment complex, and the apartment complex was next to a co-op. So there's, of course, like tons of goats over there and stuff, chickens, and little cattle and that kind of stuff. So my dad comes over there, stays the night, wakes up the next morning, and someone had taken one of those goats and dismembered it, put it in the back of his car, and bashed his windshield out, slashed his tires, wrote all over it, "Don't come back here," you know, all that stuff. It was, you know, blatantly because he was black and they didn't want him seeing my mom. But, you know, she had two little brown babies. And they didn't like that either. And that was not that long ago.
Now, you said in an interview before you were asked this question, and inevitably, how much racism you encountered as a kid. And you said, I didn't really encounter that.
Mm-mm. Here's the thing. I did, but I didn't really know it.
What do you mean?
Because I didn't know why I couldn't go to so-and-so's house. I didn't, you know,
You weren't as aware of the reason.
My parents really protected me because they didn't want me walking, especially growing up in the South, they didn't want me walking around being scared of people or feeling like I couldn't go fishing over here or feel unsafe in my own home. So they sheltered me from ever thinking anything about being black or white.
Was the town or the neighborhood mixed?
Yeah. I mean, where we lived, it was kind of like more... You know, I grew up in a trailer park, so you got all kinds of people in the trailer park, you know what I mean? White, black, Latino, everything, drugs, no drugs, churchgoers, you got everybody in there. So we definitely, my father and my mother definitely taught me, like, we're all the same, like, for sure, for sure.
In an opposite mood, I remember watching, there was a performance at the White House, and you were at the Obama White House up on that stage. It may be a very different spirit. What was that experience like for you?
You know, the one thing I remember the most about that experience was taking my dad to the White House to meet Barack Obama. And I'm like tearing up because it made him so happy. And I'll never forget the big smile on his face. He was so proud. Sorry. Yeah. Just like a little boy, just beaming. I've never seen him smile that big. And that's the one thing I remember. And it still makes me emotional. Even talking about it right now, it still makes me emotional.
Did he get to meet Obama or just see him from afar?
Yeah, he met him. He was worrying me to death about meeting. I was like, "Dad, you're going to meet him. It's okay. Just relax." And he was like, "But I got to get his autograph." And I was like, but my dad approached him, shook his hand, and handed him a little piece of paper. And he's like, "Will you sign that for me?" And Barack took it, but my dad never got it back. And he was just losing his mind about that little piece of paper. So about a week goes by, and my dad gets a letter in the mail, and it was from the White House. And my dad opens it, and Barack has sent him this beautiful piece of stationery and wrote his name on it. It was amazing.
So speaking of your dad, at one point you were talking about the possibility of making a few dollars or becoming famous, and you said, you know, this is when you were 26, I'm 26 years old, what do I need $5 million for? Maybe I'll buy my dad a truck.
Yeah.
Did you buy your dad a truck?
Yeah, I bought him a truck.
What'd you get him?
Oh, I got him, it's a 2018 giant truck. I can't remember the
2018
rest.
Giant truck.
It's a mouthful.
It's the best model.
Yeah, it's the one that costs the most. That's what I got him. I asked him, I said, "Dad, do you want a new house or do you want a truck?" And he's like, "I'll have a truck, please." He don't care where he lives. He just wants he loves cars.
You know, you just remembered your dad meeting Barack Obama and being moved by it then and moved by it now. The same country that elected Donald Trump, and we're going through something radically different right now. How do you experience the Trump moment, particularly when it comes to race and racism?
If I'm being honest, there's part of me that's scared. I don't feel as safe as I used to. I have my reasons. You know, I traveled America last year, just for the leisure, looking for a new place to live. And so we stop in this little town. I'm not going to say the name of the town. Don't want to give it a bad rap. But we pull up in this little town in Wyoming and get out, me and my partner. She wants to take a picture of the post office, this old post office. I was like, okay. So we're just standing on the side of the road. Here comes this big old white truck pulling up, and they throw fireworks at us. And as they pull by, they got a Confederate flag on the back. I'm just like, wow. I mean, I didn't know how to, I mean, I was angry, but then I was like, what am I going to do? Can't do none of them boys, you know what I mean? I don't even know where I am. And I was so angry, started crying. I was just sitting there trying to eat my steak for dinner, and I couldn't even eat it. I was just so upset. And that's kind of how it feels. It's like, it feels dangerous. It is dangerous, actually. Having a man like that in office is very dangerous. I mean, look around, man. It's just inciting people to do all kinds of things. They think they have an excuse. So we happen to have a guy who just doesn't watch what he says and doesn't think about consequences of words. So
what can an artist do about it?
Inspire other people. I think that's the most important thing, is to be light, to be a beacon of light, because it is a dark time in American history. And it's not all of President Trump's fault. It's not all his fault. It's a long time coming, to be honest with you, because there's always been these little groups, these little cells of people who want to go back to the good old days. And now they're just exposing themselves because they feel like they have permission to do so. So I think I'm going to try to be positive here and say that I think this was a necessary evil to maybe get to the next place where we could fix some ruptures in our own society. Mm.
Brittany Howard, thank you so much. And good luck to you in all things.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brittany Howard's solo album, Jamie, comes out this week. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening. Be sure to join me next time. We've got a special show coming up. I don't want to spoil it, but let's just say it's high time that we tackled a budding industry. That's next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Meng Fei Chen and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.